Part 1. Charles MacDonald looked through the dining room window. A winter sun shone on the wet pavements below his window. He was now in one of his reflective moods, watching the general public to-ing and fro-ing their places of work, or shopping, perhaps. An air of organized chaos seemed to be controlling them all. Gone now was the panic of the Zeppelin raids he had once observed through his window. Now there was peace and calm as he lit and smoked his first cigar of the day. The road was very busy, too, more noticeable now with those damned infernal smoke-emitting cars that made an intolerable racket as they roared down the highway, scaring one's horses as they passed, tooting their bloody horns. Like most things modern, he was sure this fad would pass. There was no future for them. Although, again, he reflected on the battlefield where those dreadnought tanks did scare the Hun, although in fairness they scared our troops as well. Mechanical warfare did help shorten the war, but, like these damn cars, there was probably a time and a place for them, but not here. No. While there were still horse and carriages, or hackneys for hire, for those daring the weather, their choice was the Ascot open carriage. Charles' cigar now smoked, and the stump placed in his ashtray, he sat waiting for his own landau carriage, with the four white horses to take him to the House of Commons. Only then did he notice the antics of a beggar in army uniform, his flashes identified he had served in the artillery, now reduced to begging, for Charles could clearly see that he had suffered an injury by the amputation of his right leg. He had rolled up the right leg of his uniform trousers neatly, and tied off the roll with what appeared to be his lanyard. Only then did this beggar have the audacity to sit on his house steps, his crutches placed in a position to deliberately impede the flow of pedestrians, obviously a tactic he had used many times, as his bowl was filling with coins. As soon as there was a break in the pedestrians' movements, his hand swooped into the bowl to deposit most of the coins into his pocket. Charles's butler had also seen the beggar. Ever hopeful the master had not noticed him. He left the house quickly to send him on his way, with a stern telling off, but also with a quick smile and a savoir-faire manner of slipping the beggar a sixpence piece into his bowl. Charles smiled, making a mental note to add sixpence to the butler's hand before he left his house. It was the same story everywhere. Hospitals full of wounded, and those who had lost all reason of their minds. Many had been executed by their own comrades' firing squads as lacking moral courage, or refusing to fight further, before it was discovered by specialist doctors that it was a condition later to be known as battle fatigue. Added to all this chaos, there were those soldiers and sailors who lost their lives on active service. Plus, there were many of the pilots of the Royal Flying Corps who were not actually shot down in their wood and canvas aeroplanes by killing the pilots, or the worst scenario, the enemy's bullets setting their engines on fire. The pilots had to remain in their burning airplanes, for they had no parachutes, which in turn left the pilot with several choices. Either shoot themselves with their own issue revolver, or commit suicide by throwing themselves from their aircraft, or last but not least, to sit in the cockpit and burn to death. This was the expected actions of a British or even continental gentleman. Had their lordships allowed the issue of parachutes, which were issued to balloon spotters, then some airmen could have been saved, but no. To use a parachute was simply lacking moral courage. This could not be tolerated, or even considered, as German pilots were not issued with parachutes either. No, the butcher's bill was enormous. The cream of all our youth was now dead, handicapped, or mentally deranged. The prognosis of the latter was they would never recover their sanity ever again. How could this country ever get back to leading the world in industry and commerce? Charles had made a point of saying this in the House, and always received massive support for any proposed ideas he could discuss. Charles looked about his room. This was the dining room in the evening, but at this time of day it was his, a gentleman's study. Even the staff or his wife would have to knock on the door and wait to be invited into his room, and even then it had to be an urgent matter. The house could be classified as comfortable, a mere six bedrooms, but big enough for them, and in the middle of Knightsbridge, which was generally extremely quiet, except, of course, the road noise. a point shared with all the other occupants of the row who were of the same ilk as himself in social standing. He was glad in one way. 1914 through 1918 had not been good years for him, and he sincerely hoped that 1919 would be better, since this was the year that finally would signal the legal end of the Great War. Furthermore, the precariousness of the resulting post-war reconstruction was now visibly demonstrated by the forcible expression in the changing social attitudes, as well as diminishing standards, that seemed to have commenced with all their expectations of the arrival of the 1920s. New social openness of the time was a very strong reminder of the current changes, as customs and institution, which had, at least outwardly, bound 19th-century bourgeois and Victorian Europe, all but collapsed. It now seemed that a new epidemic was sweeping the streets where one lived. As well as one's staff, those that were left, since so many had been enticed into labor within the factories for ridiculously high wages, that altered their behavior and manners when addressing their betters. The same fad now dictated their choice in clothing, music, and art, as well as their social manners. However, they were now paying the price of their disloyalty, as the factories laid them off and they came back, cap in hand, to be in service again, no doubt expecting the same ridiculous factory wages. Then their verbal disappointment when informed that the houses could not afford them at that cost within the household budgets. No, that had been a bad thing about the war. It gave the common people expectations above their status in life, which, in Charles's eyes, as well as fellow club members, suggested an underlying instability of the post-war social structure. For now, the superficial change substituted a demand by the common people for a needed reform. With all this talk of strikes and marching in the area of one's home, with the local police in attendance, it was all a clear sign that normal standards were slipping. Then there was the evidence of the damned so-called middle class, the growing administrative aspect of commerce, which brought to the fore the salaried individuals such as bank tellers, departmental store clerks, as well as office secretaries. It would end in tears, Charles mused, as he noticed the maid had brought a fresh cup of coffee for him. The damned woman had the effrontery not to knock on the door, as well as she had failed to inform him it had been placed on his side table. Charles saw several cars pass by on the road, belching smoke with the attendant smell, plus the grinding gearboxes and that awful noise. Here, too, there was a new move for so-called freedom, as the fast-moving Rolls-Royces, Alfa Romeos, and Hotchkisses now conveyed the smart social set from London to Brighton, or even Paris or Nice. Not that this was without mishap or accident. Only recently a well-known dancer, Isadora Duncan, died in an unusual manner when her long, flowing scarf caught in the spokes of the wheel of her chauffeur-driven convertible, which caused her to choke to death, and creating a huge outcry against the driver. This physical movement was also matched by a new social openness, giving, it would seem, the occasion for people to act in such an outlandish manner. For the first time in his memory, women smoked in public, actually daring it to be acceptable to their betters. They dressed in a frippery manner, and no longer, it would seem, to be tied to any sort of decency, as they displayed their ankles when they walked. In addition, they smoked and talked in groups. Never had there been such a blatant disregard for their station in life, as well as not observing their husband's sound and knowledgeable directions and decency. All this was happening not only in England. Standards were declining all over the world, as one read in the news sheets. The cabarets of Berlin were becoming notorious gathering places for the demimonde, these twilight people, given to pleasures and pursuits that would be decreed as immoral in all the Victorian drawing-rooms. Paris, also to its shame, now boasted being a city of lights, competing with the brighter and ever more provocative music hall productions. It was an American singer and dancer, Josephine Baker, who appeared on the stage at the Folies Bergère, attired in little more than a few bananas. She created a sensation, as well as a name for herself, possibly not the one she had thought about. One sometimes wondered if she even knew the words. However, there was a disturbing evidence of more than just social unrest, peculiar to the interwar period and its influence, more of a cohort group than what could be regarded as a social group. It was the war veterans who generally expressed a right-wing political attitude, now joining together in organizations through which they could express either a common spirit of nostalgia for the war days, or of discontentment with the dull confusion, as well as the lack of national direction that they found in the era of peace. Although their displays of camaraderie, as they met in pubs and beer halls to drink and reminisce, were socially acceptable enough, they, by their very presence, were in the hub of political pressure groups, which were now disturbing government officials. There were threats of strikes from the miners, supported by whispers that they would be supported by the road services, as well as the railways' employees. British tanks had been deployed on the streets of Dublin as a deterrent against threatened uprising there. The world, in Charles's view, had learned nothing, just still more deaths that proved nothing. He was not alone in this theory, as many at the club he knew would agree with him, and, in addition, were scandalized, as it would seem that women were trying for membership. He snorted, and let that thought linger for a moment. Not in my damn lifetime, and that was certain. Why, he would fight such a move with all his might. A woman's place was in the home, looking after husband and children. They ran their homes, dealt with staff, and oversaw the meals menu. They were far too busy. Damned impudence if anyone was to ask him. He turned from his deliberations, having achieved nothing except waste the remaining coffee that had now gone cold in the cup. As he turned, the butler was there, holding his coat, hat, and gloves, while the maid held his cane. "Your ministerial carriage is without, my lord." "Thank you, Jeeves. And my briefcase?" "Ready for you on the hall table, my lord." Charles MacDonald struggled into his coat, and put on his gloves after accepting his hat, took his cane off the maid, who did a little curtsy. If he had blinked, he would have missed it. His wife, Prudence, stood by the front door, as always. She still looked beautiful, as she did when they had first met, then, after a customary courtship of some 2 years, they married. She quickly came to understand his importance in the life of their society, so it fell to her to organize the staff as well as the house. Prudence showed a grasp of home economics, and was quite thrifty with the house allowance, added to which all dinners and small parties were always social events. Nothing too lavish, yet notable. He knew he had chosen well, for she would never assume she could spend her money she had brought to the marriage without his permission, which he did not often give. The cost of living was now scandalous. The carriage, horses, as well as driver and groom, all took so much money, as did other essentials, his brandy, cigars, and his gaming bills. One had to keep an eye on the expenditure side of not only the government, but his own. She was again dressed, he noticed, in that particularly fetching dress she had purchased from some shop with a funny title, in Paris. "You do remember, dear, I'm entertaining the shaman and the ladies' committee. We're discussing the London poor." "Of course." "Prudence, a word to the wise. Do not promise money. Only make a note of the amount, and we can discuss it upon my return." "Of course, dear. You know I would not do otherwise. But it is a very worthy charity, and they are in such a plight."
"You'll not be visiting them, I hope."
"No, dear. The shaman is arranging all the visits, as well as distributing food, clothing, etc."
"Not money. They'll only spend it on drink, and they're not clean."
"You have to be ever so careful, Prudence." "Of course, dear. That is, we, the ladies' committee, have already made your views on drink known, and even the shaman so much agrees with your views he does not let alcohol touch his lips." "Do we know him socially, Prudence? I mean, where does this fellow come from? Does he know he's dealing with ladies?" "Yes, dear. He's from India, and I believe he did tell us he was one of the minor princes and has devoted his life to the world poor."
"Yes, Prudence. One has to be away now, meeting at 2 after lunch, and then I may be late, so I'll stay at the club. Get back home after lunch tomorrow."
"People just do not realize what the pressure of running this country does to one." "No, dear.
but you are so well suited to the task. I often say to my ladies that you have a mind like a razor." Charles dutifully kissed his wife on the cheek, smiled, ignored the staff, save the butler, to whom he slipped a sixpence piece into his hand as he descended the steps to the carriage. The carriage door was held open by the coachman for Charles to enter. He stood to attention as Charles approached the carriage door, and only as he arrived at the carriage did the coachman salute him. Sitting on the leather seat, Charles opened his briefcase and took out a freshly ironed newspaper, not even aware that the coach door had been closed, with the coachman returning to his own seat and shaking the reins for the horses to pull the carriage away from the curb, just as he was also unaware of Prudence, standing on the steps to see him off, as she did every time he left the house. For Charles, the day's business had begun, with checking the share prices, addressing the crossword, which he timed himself on his gold Hunter watch, eager to beat his personal best record of 9 minutes and 30 seconds.